Welcome to the Conan Doyle Casebook, where there's always a story to tell. Welcome to the Conan Doyle Casebook, and this week we are talking about Robert Burns, and it's with Susan Cohen, founder and owner of the Wee Book Company, and an interest in Robert Burns, who was actually born on the 25th of January, 1759, in the Age of Enlightenment. But also the time where superstition and the belief in the supernatural were intertwined with everyday life. And today, we will be exploring some of these stories. Hello, Susan.
Hello, how are you?
Not bad at all. Now, your interest in Robert Burns, tell me more.
I love Robert Burns. I don't think I've ever made a secret about that. And I and millions of other people around the world. Do you know, he's one of our most famous exports. And during his life, he was the first poet in the English-speaking world to reach the status of a rock star. And it was all the more remarkable because he was born into poverty. He was referred to during his lifetime as the heaven-taught ploughman. Isn't that amazing? And in fact, you know what? One of his pieces of work is the most performed piece of work, poetic work, in the world. What do you think that is?
Tam O'Shanter?
Nope. Something that we all sing every year at
Auld Lang Syne.
Auld Lang Syne. Auld Lang Syne is the most performed poetic work around the world. And can you think of any other poets in the world where we get together once a year to celebrate his life and work?
That's true.
Burns Night is a phenomenon, and it grows and grows and grows every year into something truly special. So yeah, he's left a real legacy. When you talk about Burns, though, you have to be a bit careful, because there's a lot of debate rages about his life, the way he lived it, the way he treated people, particularly women. So when you talk about Burns and his work, it's really important to make sure that you say, do you know what? You can be a fan of his work without making any judgment call, moral or otherwise, on his life choices. And just the statistics talk alone. The man had 12 known children by 4 women. And countless others were discarded by the wayside. So it is really important to add that caveat when you're talking about Burns.
So there would still be descendants of Robert Burns then today, possibly?
Absolutely. One of the very famous multi-millionaire designers in the world, whose name escapes me quite frankly at the moment, discovered that he was a descendant of Robert Burns, somebody like Hugo Boss or somebody like that. And he kept it secret for a long time because the family regarded it as a deep shame.
And yet he's one of the most celebrated poets now.
But you know, I think that's the thing about Burns. He is an absolute paradox. And when you read through his works, so what would you do during COVID lockdown apart from just sit down and read the whole of the poetic works of Burns, which is what I did last year when I was writing a book about him. And writing a book about his work and paraphrasing some of his work. To be perfectly honest with you, when you start reading through his work, poem after poem, letter after letter, song after song, you realise that the man is and was. I always speak about him in the present tense because to me he's alive. You know, his work lives and breathes. But actually, such a paradox. You know, if you met him on a good night, he was probably the best fan in the pub ever. Up there, giving it some, leading the community singing. But if you met him on a bad day, he'd be in the corner probably weeping into his beer, and you'd have to carry him home because he'd be in the depths of despair. He oscillated between love and hate and joy and despair and pride and shame, all of those things we know because of what he left behind. He wrote with his heart on his sleeve, and he wrote with a bravery and an honesty that, to be honest with you, would make your eyes water.
And that's the thing, because, you know, he was brought up in a time where we're talking about superstitions and superstitions handed down through family and that belief in the supernatural. So he must have been brought up with that and some of the stories. He would have heard all these stories at the time.
Yeah, that's true. So sorry, didn't mean to cut you off there. Sorry, carry on.
So he would have been brought up with these very much at the time, and these stories handed down through family, which I understand affected him in life and appear in the odd poem or two that he has.
You know, that's absolutely true. So I think there's two things there. The first thing is that religious imagery in that time occurred constant. It was a constant in terms of literature that's been left behind. And so, as you know, and I know, that when you go to church or you go to your place of worship, you talk about life and death as easy as breathing, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no small conversation to be had around religion, that's for sure. The concept of life and death is always going to be there. In terms of the folklore and witchcraft and ghosts and the concept of the living devil, actually, those were concepts that were very much ingrained in the society of the time. And Burns's mother and his childhood nurse, actually, a lady called Betty Davidson, she regaled the child heavily, the family heavily, with tales of witchcraft and witches and the word warlocks as he was growing up. And so for certain, he also lived in times, of course, when, you know, the witch hunts in Lowland Scotland. So yes, that is something that is certainly sort of circulating as he was writing. Such thing as historical fact. All we're talking about here is the interpretation of the work he left behind. But you can see that there's a degree of spirituality in the way in which he writes, that's for sure.
So was he quite a religious man?
You know, he did talk about religion a lot. There's a poem called Holy Willie's Prayer. And you would think just from the title, wouldn't you, that it was all about the sort of celebration, if you like, of religion. In fact, that particular poem is all about the two-faced nature, the duplicitous nature, sometimes, of people who hold themselves out to be religious and then imply that they're not. You know, what he hated most of all was somebody who was two-faced. They presented themselves to the world one way, and in fact, that's not what they were at all. And he certainly was somebody who talked about God, who talked about the release of death sometimes when he was in despair. He talked about the spectre of death sometimes when he was, you know, full of unbounded joy. How he felt as a person, who knows, but certainly he talks about religion and he wrote about religion almost as easy as breathing, to be honest with you. Yeah.
And how does paranormal feature in these poems? What's that thread that comes through them from his childhood, his beliefs and his experiences?
Well, you know, that's really interesting. I've looked at a couple of poems, says she, reaching for her book. I'm still one of those people, Ewan, that still has got hard copy books. She's the only person in the world that does that.
I love that feel of turning the pages.
Turning the pages. Well, you know, there are collections of poems which have been grouped into certain headings. And one of the headings is Burns and the Supernatural. And I think, I'm not quite sure, if I'm being honest with you, when I look through them, I'm not quite sure whether in fact they are supernaturals we we would interpret them. You know, we would interpret ghosts and spectres and all sorts of things. Again, it is an interpretation thing, but certainly the deeply spiritual nature of the world with a sixth dimension, if you like, I think possibly does recur in it. And nothing more obvious than in Tam O'Shanter. Tam O'Shanter is that famous narrative poem, isn't it? Where Tam has it one too many and then goes home on his horse. And then on his horse, when he comes past the Alloway Kirk, he encounters witches and warlocks in the dance. And I just want to read just a wee bit out, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Let's have a little look and just see. This is, I think, very evocative of the belief of another world. And I'll touch on that otherworldliness in a minute. Warlocks and witches in a dance, ne cotillon brent new from France, but hornpipes, jigs, strathspeys and reels put life and metal in their heels. A Winnick bunker in the east, there sat old Nick in the shape of a beast, a towsy tyke, black, grim and large. To gie them music was his charge. He screwed the pipes and gart and skirl till roof and rafters a' did dirl. Coffins stood round like open presses that showed the dead in their last dresses. There's nothing more evocative, is there, than seeing open coffins with dead people living in their last dresses. That casting up of spirit, I think, does feel that way. But, you know, in preparation for today, I did come across a study, which I wonder what you think about it, Ian. It says that, in fact, when he was writing Tam O'Shanter, he was touching upon the notion of what used to be called, and still are called, thin places. Have you heard of those?
The thin places. I've heard of such things as the thin veil, and we talk about Halloween and the veil at its thinnest.
Well, you know what? In ancient times, the notion of thin places was used to describe those places where the distance between this world and another collapses. And it was often used in a religious sense in Scotland, but in Alloway, where Robert Burns was born, or where he set, you know, Tam O'Shanter, the real and the imaginary, for him, felt very close together. And I find that absolutely fascinating, don't you? Because there's still that debate about standing stones, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this, haven't we? We've talked about how certain locales and certain places feel different. And it's not using your conventional five senses, your taste and your sound, and your sense of smell, whatever. That sixth sense, you can't put your finger on it, but you know that there is something spiritually different from that place compared to others. Do you feel that?
Yes, exactly.
You've had examples of being in what you would think of as thin places, haven't you?
Yes, you have places that are very, very atmospheric, and it's very difficult to explain some of the feelings that you get or to put them into words, if that makes sense. And certainly I'm thinking of such places as, you know, a year ago I visited the Standing Stones at Kilmartin on the West Coast, and there was something, it was very peaceful, but there was something very atmospheric and kind of went through you, so to speak.
I have to say, I think one of the theories about something like Tam O'Shanter is that when he comes across Alloway Kirk in the middle of the night, and even though, you know, Tam O'Shanter's had a few, just one too many, Uncle Fu, I think was the word, Uncle Fu, an awfully happy, there was just something which was almost a portal to the other world. And that sense of otherworldliness often does underscore Burns' writing. He does talk about death sometimes being a release for the poor man, the working man. He was a great person, you know, talking about the struggles of poverty and the struggles of men and women simply to survive in those days. And he does talk about, you know, the sense of death being a release. Now, you would only really talk about death being a release if you had a deep sense of spirituality, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that in itself, perhaps for me, is the most persuasive evidence that he was a deeply spiritual man.
And there's also, I was reading as well, that there's a poem, I'm not quite how you pronounce it, it's addressed to the devil, but I know the devil is not pronounced as that, but it's a poem that pokes fun at folk beliefs about the devil and his common poetic framework of the time. So he really does go all out to poke that.
He does. He casts up the deals. He put, you know, the deals of the excise man, perhaps, is the one that you're thinking of. He worked as an excise man. He goes, the deals of the excise man. And the deal is quite a spectre, you know. It lurks throughout his poetic works. An old Nick that's referred to in Tam O'Shanter, and that of course is the deal, who's, you know, sort of casting up the skirl of the pipes and that. So it's a sensory thing as well. He's hearing things, he's seeing things, he's riding for his life that, you know, the witches start coming after him. And then one of the witches he becomes attracted to because she's wearing a really short skirt. And, you know, it's just relentless, relentless, relentless. Something extraordinary about his work. Always, 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 always extraordinary. Yeah, I found the passage about death as well in terms of not spirituality. Again, extraordinary. He wrote something called A Man Was Made to Mourn. And he says in his last stanza, he says, "Oh death, the poor man's dearest friend, the kindest and the best, welcome the hour my aged limbs are laid with thee at rest." So to embrace the concept of death, I think, is interesting.
It's just very much like he had that deep belief that there was something else there, that
something beyond
poetry, yeah. The death was the release.
Yeah.
It was off to a better life, whether it was that thinnest place or what he described there.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the Reverend Diane Jolly, isn't it? Oh, it's a blessed release.
Now, he has, of course, connections with Edinburgh, but we often talk about it being such a small world and the spooky scenarios that happen. And, of course, a few weeks you were doing a video on Robert Burns. And someone that was very associated in his life was that of Clorinda. And you were doing this video from, I remember watching this, and someone realised, this is where my grandparents lived. This was in the very house, the very spot they stayed in. So who was Clorinda?
Clorinda was a lady called Agnes Macclehose. And the reason that she's so part of our culture is because she is Burns's Nancy. And Nancy was referred to in one of the greatest love poems of all time, called A Fond Kiss. And A Fond Kiss was written as a farewell to Nancy. Nancy lived on Carlton Hill at one point, yeah, in your grandparents' flat, I believe.
Yeah, just at the bottom. I mean, it's made into flats now, but such an old building. And I never knew that until after they moved in.
That's a real piece of history just there. I was filming at Clorinda's graveside. The reason that we refer to her as Clorinda was that she and Burns exchanged love letters and poems. She was a very educated, very smart lady. And she really did match him word for word sometimes. And they had pet names, which is something that happened at the time. Sylvander and Clorinda. would write to one another. So her headstone, which, to be honest with you, I don't know why it made me sad, but it did. We were in Canongate Kirk one night. We were Kirkyard. We were filming, and there were groups of visitors being shown around the Kirkyard. You know how it is. And we were standing there the whole time, and nobody came near Clorinda. It's a very small, very, and you know, quiet, if you like, grave, but extremely important in our culture. Yeah. So that beautiful passage where Burns writes, "I'll ne'er blame my partial fancy. Nothing could resist my Nancy, but to see her was to love her. Love but her, and love forever." How beautiful is that?
That's absolutely. I mean, when you look at his poetry, it's just something. It kind of hits that nerve. It hits the inside, and you can't help to be carried away with the emotion at times as well.
You know what? You completely hit the nail on the head. They talk about the poetry that he wrote was absolutely poetry from the heart. Every bit was dripping with emotion. I mean, the Selkirk Grace, for example, you know, some hae meat and canna eat, and some would eat that want it, but we hae meat and we can eat, so let the Lord be thank it. You know, the depth in four lines, just for that, you know, for a grace, it's extraordinary. The man was an artist, the likes of which possibly we haven't seen since, possibly we'll never see again. Not that I'm biased or anything.
Do you think in, say, 200 years' time, when we're long gone and there's other generations, do you think Burns will be just as important then?
Well, that's a lovely question. I genuinely believe so. I honestly do believe so. I believe that his poetry is timeless because it addresses the fundamental human emotions of love and loss and parenthood and shame and depression and elation and pride in your country and the suspicion of people when they pretend to be something they're not. All these basic things, I should imagine, are going to be timeless. I mean, he died in 1796. Where are we now, 2021? You know, he's going strong. I think probably he'll always go strong.
I mean, from what you said there about life and how he looks at that, he really takes life back to its bare bones in many ways, all the emotions and what everybody deals with.
He really does.
He really hits it on the head. And
he really does.
As well.
He really does. And he was many different people, which mirrors a theory that I've got about myself and all sorts of, you know, everybody else in life. You and I both know that a person is not fixed. So you're not one personality type. You are many personalities wrapped up in one piece of humanity here, you know? So Burns was both cad and bounder, but also caring lover. He was great friend, but also he was, you know, he was a loner. He was sociable, yet he was shy. He was so many different things. And I think what marks him out as different was the fact that he was brave enough to put it completely all out there, warts and all.
And that's the thing about him. Now, you have brought out a book on Burns, haven't you?
I have. It's called The Wee Book of Burns, The Bard, and it's published by the Wee Book Company. You can find us at theweebookcompany.com, and we're on Facebook constantly, aren't we? Constantly.
We're constantly on Facebook the whole time.
Constantly on Facebook. And I was lucky enough to be asked by the National Library of Scotland to do the talk on Scottish humour, which touched upon Burns for Burns Night last year. So that's on YouTube. So yeah, all over it.
And you have the map. The odd Burns speech or two at the Burns Supper, I seem to remember as well, haven't you?
You know, I have, and you and I, once the world opens up again, I've been talking about doing Burns Suppers hither and thither. for all sorts of people. Because one of the real conundrums, I think, is that you know, it's only done on you know, once a year. But to be perfectly honest with you, why? He celebrated all year, you know. he kicked up his heels, not just once a year, all year. I don't know why our celebrations should always just be confined to one night a year.
One day, and yet we sang, as we say, one of his popular ones at Hogmanay, and also other points during the year we seem to sing Auld Lang Syne as well at times.
Such an emotive thing.
Yes,
You know, should old acquaintance be forgot? It's such an emotive thing of binding people together. We even know that we hold hands. And then it's not enough for us to hold hands. We actually get closer and we cross our arms and we pull people closer to us.
I was about to ask that very question because I always wondered why we hold hands and then we cross the hands and bring everybody in.
It's a bringing of people in. And that, I think, is a very Burns thing, you know. You're never going to be able to read Burns at a distance. There's no such thing as being able to hold him at arm's length. And that's translating into Auld Lang Syne. And I feel that somewhere he's watching, saying, do you know what? Look at me. I'm still alive in different ways. I'm still there.
And again, in 200 years' time, we may still be singing that song at every Hogmanay and other times through the year. It's quite a thought, actually.
Such an achievement, isn't it? Such a legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Such a legacy for someone who lived such a short life.
Exactly.
To have left such a lot. And I have to say, it's a real life lesson because he was very ill. He experienced real ill health in his life and he was an artist in a hurry. In the same way as I remember David Bowie, when he knew he was dying, started writing and producing his art because he knew his time was limited. Burns knew that from an early age. He had rheumatic fever when he was a child and was actually of quite weak disposition. So he wrote so much. He wrote on all sorts of things, you know, notebooks. And he even had a diamond pen and he would write on window panes. He wrote. Therefore, he has given us this massive volume of work.
And one wonders if he realised quite the legacy he would leave.
You know, that's a really brilliant, brilliant point. I think there is evidence to suggest that he was very much aware of his own brilliance and loved the fact that he was called the Bard.
And that's
a lovely thing, isn't it? Even though he died in poverty, the fact that he was aware that he was in some way going to be celebrated after he was gone. That's a gift, I think, in its own way.
Again, a fascinating subject. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And I know there's so much we could talk about. And I know there's other subjects you're interested in, spirituality, hypnotherapy, everything. So it would be great to talk about that in the future as well.
Lovely.
So Susan from the Wee Book Company, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.